Father, we come before you this evening to give thanks to you, the Creator. We thank you for the beauty of this day. We thank you for the beauty of this universe and of this world. Thank you that the things you have created are not just there to give a balance to nature, but they are there also for us to enjoy. And your word says that through the things that are seen, we understand those that are unseen. Your eternal power, your majesty and your glory. And I pray that this evening, as we look at this topic of the wonders of the natural world, the things that you created, we will appreciate you to a greater and greater extent. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Amen.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you, Tina, and all the others who have prepared and invited me and made us yummy food. That was great. It's not often, I don't think I've ever spoken after garden party. That's nice. That's a good kind of after dinner speaker, isn't it? And I'm going to be speaking on a project that I've been working on for a couple of years. And the aim is to think about several areas of biology, research that we think is exciting, and the questions about meaning and purpose that it raises for us. So in a sense, what we're doing is we're leaping over all the debates and the issues as such and landing in a place where I'd love for the whole of the science and faith in a perfect world where it would be, which is just reveling in the science and enjoying it. And as a Christian myself, letting that help me to worship God and raise some questions for me. So whatever you believe, whatever you've come from, whatever level of science you've studied, some or not at all, hopefully there'll be something for you in what I say tonight. So I'll just tell you really briefly where we're going. I'm going to talk a little bit about whether faith can enhance science. Can it go? I'm sorry, my text is slightly small, but never mind. It's good for your eyes, probably. Can science enhance faith? Can it go the other way around? Two case studies about wonder in biology. I'm going to tell you two stories, essentially. And then thinking about the questions of meaning and purpose that they raise, and thinking about the compatibility of these stories with the existence of God. So that's where we're going. So I'll start thinking about from faith to science. Really briefly, I'm never quite sure how much exposure people have had to the science of faith conversation. So I always think it's good to give an introduction about where I'm coming from in that respect. So obviously there are lots of Christians in the past who have been scientists. Nearly all of the founders of Western science, anyway, science in the West were Christians. People like Johannes Kepler, who included a lot of prayers in his scientific writings. He wanted to be a theologian, first of all, but he got often offered this second-rate job as a natural philosophy professor, which was what they called science. Eventually came to terms with that and realised that this could be his vocation, this could be his way of worshipping God, and he peppered his writings with his prayers and theological thoughts. There's Robert Boyle, who was a well-to-do Irish gentleman who did some science in his spare time, some very good science in his spare time, and was a very serious Christian. And of course, Isaac Newton, got to mention someone from Cambridge, who wrote more words of theology than science. I'm not sure we should read his theology. We should certainly make the most of his science. I haven't read any. That's not fair. I haven't read any. And he can't defend himself. But anyway, I'm sure he would if he was here. And then I've got some living scientists, including a couple of women, just to balance things off. Frances Collins, one of my heroes, who was the leader of the Human Genome Project, which is an international project, now running the National Institutes of Health, the equivalent of the MRC in the US. And then a couple of astronomers, Catherine Blundell, who's a professor of astrophysics in Oxford, and Jennifer Wiseman, who is one of the chief scientific people involved in the Hubble telescope right now. So I was, as a student, I certainly find it tremendously encouraging to hear about the living scientists particularly, who I could look to, who were faithfully serving God in through doing their science as a Christian, and they saw that as part of serving God, part of their Christian faith. So that's kind of, in a sense, if I stopped now, I'd have done my job, I think, but I'm not going to. But certainly when I've gone into schools in the past, that's the one thing I want to get across. There are people out there who are doing this. There have been big influences over the years from theology to science. There is our blue planet. The idea that the Earth is good and it's worth looking at, and there's nothing there that can hurt our faith. It might challenge us to think that came from Christian theology. As people began to do science in this country, they had to defend what they were doing, the same as you have to defend any research here now. And people would, you know, this was one thing. You could say also the idea, well, this is certainly an influence that went in. There is a forest, it's a beautiful place, it's kind of a magical place. It's an old growth temperate rainforest in the north coast of, on the coast, west coast of Canada. But only magical in a sense that it's really lovely, it's wonderful, and it's great to explore. There's nothing there that I have to not touch. Well, obviously I have to be responsible, but I don't need to worry. I don't believe as a Christian that there's anything there that is going to upset God if I study it, touch it, taste it, try it. So that frees me up to explore the world. And there's a brain scan. Now it's very obvious to us that if you want to understand the world, you have to investigate it, but that was a relatively new idea several hundred years ago, the idea that you have to get off your chair. You can't just do some logic and work from first principles. And we have actually, it was some Greek philosophers who thought that, but thankfully there were other Greek philosophers who thought you did have to touch things, get off a chair and do experiments. And they were the ones who influenced the origin of science around the world. And certainly for a Christian, from Christian theologians, or certainly the early scientists here in this country would be saying, who are we to know how the world is put together? God did it whichever way he liked. We have to go and find out how he did it. Last one, the beautiful picture of the universe. Not only is it stunning, but it's governed by the laws of physics. Well, we call them laws because particles and atoms and light behave in law-like ways. And investigating those laws was almost kind of like a step of faith. The scientists had to believe that there was a God sustaining the universe, and that if they started touching and doing experiments, then they might find some regularities there, because so far what they had learned about God made sense. There was what they saw in the Bible were being taught about a God who put in place seasons and stars and regularities. So they stepped out and tried to find other regularities in the world, and they did. So I don't think that's terribly disputed, the idea that there was an influence from theology into science, but I think it's really interesting to think about that. You could almost come up with a theology of science. I think you've had Tom McLeish here, haven't you? Okay, so this comes from him in a sense, or I mean anyone who's a scientist and a Christian could come up with this. All creation is God's domain. It's something that we can investigate. Creation is very good, comes from Genesis 1. If you add that to the equation, you also add humankind is called to serve and preserve the earth. You will hear about that from Hilary Marlowe next year. And Genesis 2, if you come to that, add that all together and you get science as a form of worship, which is not something I've been told when I was a science student, but I would love to have known it because it would have given me another reason to work hard. I did work hard, but it would have given me yet another reason to work hard. And I have to have a quote from Michael Faraday because I work at the Faraday Institute. The book of nature which we have to read is written by the finger of God. So he was a Baptist. Preached in his Baptist chapel in London, and believed that what he was doing was uncovering God's works. So that is my the way I put science and faith together, a great big Venn diagram. Sorry, that's what happens when you let a scientist loose. So I got Christianity as the biggest circle. So that, when I decided to follow Jesus, that's it. That affects my whole life. And then this isn't to scale, but if you're feeling a bit tired, it might be fun to have a go. It's quite hard with circles, actually. You might have to start drawing other shapes. Trying to see how things overlap. I didn't sleep in the lab. They don't overlap. And I don't work in the lab anymore, so science has got a lot smaller. But all the other activities are there on the background of my Christian faith. So my behavior and my attitudes to things are the same. But there are other things that I wouldn't do in a lab. I wouldn't pray for a particular outcome for an experiment. That would be ridiculous. Who am I to tell God how he should be running the universe? I could pray that I do it well, please. And when I go out of the lab, I don't get excited about people's diseases. I'm sad for them, they're sick. Okay, but when I'm in the lab, I might find a disease terribly interesting and want to know all about it. But I don't take that attitude. So they're out of the lab. So, you know, there are these different domains in life that had different activities that are appropriate to them, but they all happen on the background of my Christian faith. And of course, when I'm in the lab, I might also pray for a colleague. I might even pray for them to get better if they're sick. So I'm a whole person, and I take that package with me wherever I go. But certainly science is something I can do within the realm of my Christian faith. And then, is there any influence from science through back into faith? I certainly think so, and I could come up with a theology of nature, if you like. I don't often use the word nature. I more often use the word creation. Try and use that whenever I can. Nature often, for people, means without God, but that's not what I mean here. Thinking of, I get this from Alistair McGrath, theologian from Oxford, who says, you know, if you use theology as a lens to look at the world, does it bring things into focus? Does it work? I'm not thinking about proof for God. I'm not really thinking about evidence for God in this presentation I'm about to give. That's not what I'm trying to do. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to ask, is science consistent with belief in a loving, powerful creator? So that's a shift in thinking for some people, probably not for many in this group, and I don't know where people are coming from, but I'm not trying to make an argument for the existence of God. I'm not trying to sort out the debates and the issues. They're tremendously important, and I'm so glad you've had other people coming to do that. But I'm trying to show, I'm going to show, that what we do in science is consistent with the existence of God. And what we experience when we experience beauty, wonder, awe, sometimes for a scientist, beauty often, I think, wonder often, that may be what gets a scientist into the lab in the morning. Awe, maybe occasionally, when you've had a big day, things have come together and you've let yourself relax and just enjoy looking at the way the data are coming together. Or maybe when you see something for the first time, you might get that sense of awe, that mountaintop moment. Where does that lead you? It might lead you, if you're a Christian, to worship God. What an incredible world you've made. Asking may make you ask some deeper questions. What's it for? Why is it like this? Science isn't going to answer those questions, but it might lead into wider theological or philosophical conversation. So my own view, I'll lay it out there. I think Christian faith or theology as the lens does bring the world into clearer focus. I am really keen on building bridges, starting new dialogues about science and faith, where we really are just getting excited about the science and the questions it points to. The big questions are incredibly important. I'll leave other people to deal with them. Some of us have to do other things. When it comes to the reason for my own faith, if you want to know, those are to do with the teaching of Jesus and what I see in my own life following him and what happens to the other people around me who are doing the same. So you can ask me about that if you like. And obviously science fits into that and complements that very well. So let's talk about wonders of the living world. I love taking pictures of little beasties. They stand still long enough Birds are hard. Mammals are even harder, probably. But yeah, slug will sit still long enough for me to take a close up. So my holiday snaps are always full of this kind of thing. G.K. Chesterton was very keen on observation and wrote a really nice essay called Tremendous Trifles, where he asked, do we really notice this sort of wonderland that's around us? Very worth reading. But anyway, now I work with 6 scientists. I always try to keep in touch with people who are actually getting their hands messy in the lab. Here they are, some Americans, some English people, Brits. This is a transatlantic project. And so I want to know about the deeper sense of wonder their faith gives them. That's one of the things I talk about in God in the Lab. You lose the ignorant sense of wonder, the wow, how does it work? You know, you lose that, but then you get this deeper sense of, oh my goodness, look how it works. Sense of wonder. The questions of meaning and purpose they raise, and their own theology, they're Christians, how that fits in with science. So I'm going to tell you 2 stories from 2 of these people. The first one is a very familiar one, in a sense, about, or actually it's not about humble beginnings, apologize, that's the one slide I didn't change. It's about beauty. This is a very familiar story. This is you. This is the fertilized egg. This is the mother's and the father's DNA about to meet, come together to form a new potential person. And we know this story. We are familiar with different stages of it. And out comes the baby in the end after a lot of time and a lot of hard work. And this is Jeff Hardin, professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, who does not study human babies, he studies worm babies. And these very tiny worms, they live in damp soil. You probably have millions in your garden, a couple of millimeters long, millimeter, 2 millimeters long, and you can grow them on a little petri dish. You can look at them under a microscope. You can play around with them in a way that we really would never want to with humans, and it'd be too expensive to do it with pretty much anything else apart from worms. And you can make them these bright colours, lighting up different parts of their body, and much of the internal workings of their bodies are pretty much the same as ours. Their cells are doing the same things. They divide and move in the same ways as ours do. So you can learn a lot about, as Jeff says, with other models of car, you can learn a lot about a Rolls-Royce by studying a Ford Fiesta, essentially. That's the idea. So I'll introduce you to him. These videos I'm going to use, just a few scattered throughout the talk, are rough cuts of some videos that we filmed from interviews with the scientists that I'm working with. They do not contain animations or anything fancy. They contain pauses and even, they're not very slick. So I will apologise for them only slightly. The content is good. I'm going to show you some pictures afterwards that illustrate what he's saying. So I'll show you the pictures that went with it. Here are some embryos. These are sea urchin embryos. These are the ones that got Jeff hooked on developmental biology in the first place. You can see the cells dividing, 4, 8, I don't know, 16, 32. And those cells, each cell will divide in 2. So you get a doubling, and doubling very quickly. You have thousands of cells. And here is a worm doing its thing, developing. And so there is kind of like a ceilidh going on in here. You know, you all take hands and run towards another line of people, and one of the line of people has to drop hands and run through the arches and then pick them up again. Cells are doing very similar processes. That cellular glue he was talking about, I'm not sure if that's what's highlighted here. It might be. This might be a gut, worm gut. They're very beautiful. You can see those different cells all through its body, and so the glue is sticking them together, or the Velcro is sticking them together, and then it lets go. They might have to go off somewhere else in the body. They might form a sheet of cells all holding onto each other, and some of them go in one direction and drag the sheet with them. and make a hole. That's how the hole for your spine develops. And so this embryo, these sheets of cells, and sometimes they let go and go through the sheet and form another sheet behind it, you know. So this embryo is kind of folding up like origami. I've got a wonderful book about how human embryos develop called Life Unfolding, and I don't like the title because life doesn't unfold, it folds up. A newborn baby C. elegans worm has 959 cells. Somebody mapped them all, starting from one, dividing into two. Once they start to become specialized and become a muscle cell or a nerve cell, they kind of made this family tree of all the cells, where they go and what they do. Incredible amount of work, but it's made this an organism you really want to study for a biologist. And there it is with other different parts of its body highlighted there. And I'm pretty sure these are the junctions in between the cells that Jeff studies that are being highlighted here with these different colours, and there's a whole worm for you to see. Biologists often love the organism they're working on. They stare at it for days and months and years, and they come to really love it. You have to, otherwise you wouldn't do it. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, I think, largely. Okay, maybe symmetry, pattern, colour, maybe universal. But do you think a worm is beautiful? I don't know what floats your boat. I think they're pretty cool. I worked on zebrafish, so these little tiny zebrafish larvae I thought were incredibly beautiful. The room I worked in smelled badly, fish. But the fish, I think, were beautiful. And here's C. elegans a la Andy Warhol. Okay, so he's, in the same way a photographer would use different coloured filters when they take the picture, they'd use different coloured filters on their microscope to show up the different colours there in this embryo, the different staining, different fluorescent colours the cells have been stained with. And certainly Jeff thinks this is very beautiful, it's very artistic. Okay, it's very geeky art. But if you go to many biologists' websites, if they're a very visual kind of person, they may have constructed a nice website with some really beautiful pictures. They might even have a gallery of their famous and favorite images. And Jeff certainly is very interested in beauty. That's something he's really thought about. So I worked with him on the God in the Lab book. He's one of the people in there as well. We worked on a chapter on beauty together. And so I was really pleased to meet him and to find someone who also really appreciated and had thought and read about beauty in science and theology. Jeff is a slightly unusual scientist in that he studied theology. He nearly became a pastor, so he or a minister, he went to a seminary in the middle of his studies and decided to go back into the lab. But there is, he's thought about this a lot. And the idea of this material I've been collecting is that we produce a little study guide you could use for a small group study. So you can have the videos of these guys and some discussion questions and also some biblical input with some theologians we've been talking to as well that you can take away and delve deeper into that. But I'll tell you some of my thoughts on beauty. The beauty of the world reflects the beauty of God, I believe. That there's something of the creator there in creation that you can, there's some kind of faint analogue, analogy between what we see in creation and what there is to discover of God. In the same way that if I created something, or even my PowerPoint slides, you might be able to tell something about me from them. A little bit, not that much. You might get the wrong idea, but you might get something. And certainly if you knew me as a person, they would confirm what you knew about me, I would imagine. Or if you read my book and you saw the slides, you might think, yeah, I can see she really likes visual stuff. I really know she likes nature, you know, she loves creation. You might learn a few things. So I think it's like that, looking out at the world. And just a quote. For the glory of God, the world was created. And only the person who is touched by a ray of this glory can learn to see the presence of God in Jesus Christ. Slightly provocative quote, maybe, from Balthasar, who is a Catholic theologian who is probably almost single-handedly responsible for getting theologians looking at beauty again. He wrote this massive tome that I wouldn't attempt to read because certainly professional theologians say it's very difficult, so I'll leave that to them. I read a commentary on his work that was very interesting, and this is an area that's been ignored for a while, and now people across all the different Christian traditions are thinking about this. What can we learn about God, about his beauty or about the glory of God from looking at creation, from looking at what he's made? I need to clarify here what I mean by creation, because it has come to mean a certain view of how God might have created, which was very quickly. But I would like to claim it back in a more general sense. It's the stuff out there. That's creation. And I believe that came about. God was sustaining this long, slow process. The Big Bang, chemical origin of life and chemicals, and evolution happened and produced all the wonderful things we see. That's what I mean by creation. But in the most general sense, I just mean the stuff that's out there. The grass, clover, the bushes. Now for Balthasar, if you're the kind of person who can appreciate that and be open to what it might tell you, even in a very general sense, look at the beauty, stop, enjoy, take a breath, reflect. What questions does it make you ask? The kind of person who's going to do that is going to be open to what God, who God is, and to encounter God through the person of Jesus Christ. That's what I believe. It's an interesting thought. And of course, it can go the other way as well. Now I know God, I can appreciate what he's made even more. Another way I think we can learn, sort of go from beauty to God, is about the order and interconnectedness of everything. This is, it's so long since I took this picture, I think it's the Krebs cycle. Okay, maybe that's a little bit weird, but if you studied biochemistry or any kind of science, you learn this slightly abstract process, but then it all slots together. And, you know, if you understand how the periodic table was made, or even some of the, you know, the equations you learn in physics, what does everything, all those little numbers and letters, what do they mean? Why are they there? Why are they laid out in that equation? You learn it and it slots together and it's beautiful in a way that it just sort of makes sense and it's satisfying. And if you're that kind of geek, it might make you feel a certain sense of sort of peacefulness, and it's satisfying. And, you know, we also know things about the way the climate works, you know, all the circulation of air and water, heat, you know, this huge interconnected global forces, or even down to a very, very tiny scale. Here you have lichen, which is not a single organism. It's an algae living inside a fungus. And there are lots of different kinds of lichens, and lots of different algae, different sun-eating bacteria, shall I say, as well as yeasts, actually, that come together to form this crusty stuff that can live pretty much everywhere. It's probably one of the biggest survivors. If we have a nuclear war, we'll have what we have. What are those awful creatures? His name has just popped out. Yes, that's the one. Cockroaches and lichen. That's probably all we'll have. But that satisfying order and interconnectedness for many people is a sign of God's power, of his wisdom, of his goodness. Certainly, and I picked this idea up reading the Church Fathers, some of the earliest theologians. And there's a wonderful book that pulled out the ideas from these guys and women as well, their ideas about studying the studying creation, what can we learn about God from that? And this was one of the things they came up with. More modern theologian, Thomas Aquinas, said, each creature manifests God in some way, but the best manifestation of God is the beautifully ordered universe of all creatures functioning in relation to one another as God intended. So take a liking by itself, and you might think, yeah, this reflects something of God's creativity. Take the liking on the rock with some moss and some creatures and a person, and all those things interconnecting in a good way can tell you more about, I think, about God's wisdom. Finally, and probably the least abstract, this might appeal to some more, God creating order out of chaos. We read in Genesis and also the beginning of the Gospel of John, God's word went out and boom, we started to have order happening. And the whole figurative account of that Genesis 1 to 3 is all about God bringing order out of chaos. And the story is incredibly ordered to demonstrate that. These are snowflakes, and you can see the symmetry in the snowflake. And I tread very carefully because I know there are physicists in the room, but somehow, and I'm a biologist, the snowflake is symmetrical because the physical laws are symmetrical. As a woman called Emmy Noether came up with Noether's law that described that. He did some work with Einstein on one of his theories. I certainly knew him, was well respected by him. And I loved that. It took me a couple of days to bend my head around it, and I've completely forgotten what I understood about this when I wrote about it. But I remembered that fact that the laws of physics are symmetrical, which produces symmetry all around us. And I think that's pretty cool. So when I see that symmetry, that can remind me about how God creates order out of chaos. So I'll finish this section by letting Jeff speak himself again about beauty and the questions and the things it makes him think about. When I interviewed him for the God in the Lab book, I gave these scientists the challenge. I said, I want you to tell me about your science and your faith. You're not allowed to talk about controversial issues. I don't want to hear about how you respond to criticisms of whether you can be a scientist and a faith. I just want to know what's cool. I just want to know what gets you excited in terms of being a Christian, being in the lab. I'm going to continue. I'll keep using some beautiful pictures, but we're going to look at another completely different biological topic. And in the study material we're producing, you wouldn't normally do this, but because I'm here and we've got an hour, I'm going to give you another one. So this is about how inevitable is the existence of life in the universe. This is the Milky Way, or part of it. And this is an interesting question, not one I'd really thought about before I came to work at the Faraday Institute, but there are a number of people I've met who are working on this question. First of all, I need to give you a little bit of basic biology. If you want to build something on a construction site, you might go to look at the plans. You might write down a message about part of those plans. Take that away. Use it to help you put some building blocks together, and those building blocks might turn into some kind of machine. And that's exactly what happens in our body. The DNA code is copied into a little message called mRNA. It doesn't matter what it's called, really. Little message is taken off and used as a template, is translated word for word, almost, into a string of molecules that are little tiny ones that are added together like beads on a string. And they're called amino acids. Again, they could be called anything, it doesn't really matter. And that string of beads is coiled up and turned into a useful protein that does something in your body. Maybe keratin protein in your hair, maybe hemoglobin protein in your blood, or maybe something that's involved in making something else, like turning sugar into carbohydrate, or the other way around. I like that one, I just think so. That's what my gut's doing right now. And then to close the loop, the protein machines that are made can go back and take care of the DNA, repair it. They can copy it every time a cell divides. That whole big string of DNA, it's actually 2 meters. Give me a minute to take that in. 2 meters of DNA inside every cell that's too small to see. It's ridiculously thin. Okay, and it's coiled up very, very tightly. On a scale you could see, it's like getting several tens of kilometers of thread in a bath, which is actually pretty easy. You just wrap it around some bobbins and put it in, you know, and if you code the bobbins, you might even be able to find the one you need later on. And that's kind of what's happening inside your cells. 2 meters of DNA in every cell. I'm digressing now, but I've got a little bit of extra time. And if you took all the DNA out of your body, stretched it out, you couldn't see it because it's so thin, added it end to end, guess how far it would go? Way further in the sun. It would go to Pluto. Yeah, fearfully and wonderfully made. Quote from the Psalms, because we've already had Psalms. Anyway, so that's the process that's happening. And as an undergraduate, I had to work pretty hard to learn all the ins and outs of everything that was going on here, and that was a long time ago, so poor undergraduates now are probably learning even more about this process. But I actually loved it. Once it all slotted into place, I thought it was incredible. I could understand these processes that were happening inside my cells at a scale I was far too small for me to see. So accurately, so intricately. And not only that it's happening, that we, with our brains and our clumsy hands, it feels like when you're looking at the scale as small as a cell, we can understand it. It's incredible. But anyway, that's the background to what I'm about to tell you. You get from a message, copy it, turn it into these things, which is what we're going to think about, the amino acids that are the beads on the string that are added together to make a protein. I'm going to introduce you to Stephen Freeland, who is another person I met at the Faraday Institute. He is one of those people who has a degree from both of the universities that make up Oxbridge, so you don't really need to remember which is which or which one he went to. So he went to both of them. He's now in the US. He did some work for NASA for a while, which sounded like fun on their Life on Other Planets division. And he is very, very interested in this, the fact that every living thing shares this system, not just this system, but the exact same code, give or take some very, very tiny variations, which points to the fact that we have a common ancestor. How did this code come about? So he used the word decisions when he talked about how life had developed early on. He doesn't mean an active decision. He means that origin of life from chemicals and that evolutionary process. Very early on, a very successful genetic code was arrived at, and he's interested to find out why. Could it have been any different? What would happen if you did it again? And these are the amino acids. I'm using Lego to illustrate them. There are hundreds of kinds of building blocks that you can use to make proteins, but our bodies and the bodies of every living thing, animal, plant, bacteria, whatever, use only 20. Again, give or take one or two tiny variations. I feel like I have to say that because they're biologists sitting on the front row. Keep me right. So that 20 is quite simple. And in a sense, Stephen asked, well, here they are. They are, well, there are the 20. Sort of cartoon of what they look like. Again, they're too small to see with the naked eye. Stephen asked, why these 20, out of all the hundreds that they could have been, why these 20? Is it like a well-chosen set of building blocks? So in a sense, if, I don't know if this exists, I should find out, if there was a Lego pick and mix, that would be good, wouldn't it? Rather than these, I can sound grumpy and old, these newfangled kits with all these plastic palm trees and things. Back in the day, we had to build things out of little blocks. So if you wanted to give your child, your grandchild, your whoever, friend, you know, a proper Lego kit, you could go to the Lego pick and mix and you could get some long flat ones and some little skinny ones and some fourers and sixers and, you know, as we used to call them when we were kids, have you got a sixer? Oh, a red one? Yeah. Have you got a roof tile? Yeah. A few little people and there you are, you know. So you put together this great Lego kit, and if you were clever, you could put together a kit that they could use to build a car, a house, a boat, you know, all sorts, spaceship. you'd have to be careful you got the right numbers of different, you know, types of bricks. There may be some you wouldn't really need to make anything. Maybe, probably quite a lot of these. Well, that's Duplo, I think. And Stephen asked the same question. Have we got a really good building kit? In a sense, we've got different sizes and shapes of these amino acid beads, chemicals, beads on the string, and different chemical properties, so they can do all sorts of different things and build all the different kinds of proteins. So they did an experiment. Now, Stephen is a theoretical biochemist, so this was all on a computer. They looked at the hundreds of amino acids that exist, that are out there, and they put the information about those into the computer. They asked, are there any other sets of 20 amino acids out there that could be better than ours, that could be more flexible, more foolproof for building a whole load of proteins in our bodies? So they calculated that using the computer, leave it on all night and let it do its thing. So they looked at 100 million sets, and they only looked at three different chemical properties. They looked at size, electrical charge, because they have a little bit of a charge, like magnets, and how they behave in water. There are lots of others, but they missed them out. They missed all the other ones out. You've got to simplify to do an experiment. And they found six sets of 20 that function better than ours at building proteins. So does that mean that ours is not great? Well, I already said they simplified it. They only looked at three chemical properties. What if they looked at them all? The implication here is that it looks very much, from this computer-based experiment anyway, that the set of amino acids we have in our bodies is extremely highly optimized. So what does that tell you? Well, is it a surprise? To someone like Stephen, actually, it wasn't an enormous surprise. It was really good to have that evidence, have that data there. Wasn't it a massive surprise? Because you look out there at the universe, you look at one of the most abundant chemicals, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, they're the stuff our bodies are built of. So we're built of the stuff that is floating there, around there in the universe. And those amino acids are arriving on our planet on meteorites all the time. If there was no atmosphere on the planet, and the atmosphere is created by living things, giving off oxygen and so on, those meteorites wouldn't burn up on their way down to Earth, and those amino acids wouldn't be damaged. That's a theory of how the amino acids arrived here on Earth and how life developed after that. There are some clues about that, which I won't bore you with, but so those hundreds of amino acids were happening. 20 in that process of the chemical origin of life and the formation of the evolutionary process, 20 were picked that were really excellent, the very best set for living life on a rocky planet with that was wet, and that's what you get. So it's not surprising in a sense that there is a set that is best, because there are these constraints. An amino acid, a set of amino acids that doesn't interact with water at all is not going to be any use, because life forms in a watery environment, for example. So in a sense, you could say the origin of life was inevitable. It's going to happen. The chemicals were there. They were bumping into each other. Life evolved. Life formed. Life evolved. The best stuff was picked. So what is it? Why am I telling you this story? Because you might be wondering what conclusions I'm going to come to. There are these predictable properties. Stephen thinks that if you took life, if there is life on another planet, it might have a similar code, not exactly, might have a similar code to ours. The question is this special? Is this a story about something special? Is this a story about something inevitable that's not exciting? Or is it both? The data isn't going to tell us. You could say, well, life was going to form, so why do you need God? Or you could say, I believe God exists. Isn't it incredible that he made a universe that is so friendly to life, that a planet that does have, you know, not too much gravity, but a bit, and lots of water, life can form, and maybe we will find life on another planet in our lifetimes. Wouldn't that be exciting? I hope so. So the science isn't going to tell you what conclusion to come to. So in a sense, I've burst the bubble of, oh, I don't know how life arose. Isn't it wonderful? I've poked a hole in that bubble and completely burst it. But I've given you a better experience of wonder, hopefully, that says, isn't it clever that life arose? Isn't it amazing that it's so highly optimized? Isn't it brilliant? And then it's up to you to think about what questions that raises for you. So I realize it's an unusual story. It's not one you often hear in discussions about science and faith. It's not often we're left with a slightly more, I don't know, what do you think? The questions aren't obvious. Maybe some are, but not all of them. I'll leave you with Stephen's thoughts about what he thinks about this subject. Now, Stephen is a Christian, and he goes on to say that what he has seen in the scientific story makes sense in the light of the biblical story of creation. And interestingly, he's not only a Christian, but a scientist himself. His father was, he grew up in a vicarage. His father was a biology teacher who retrained, actually a Methodist minister. They don't have vicarages, do they? He was surrounded by science and faith from an early age and has embraced them both. So those are those two stories. A story about beauty that makes sense for a Christian in the light of the knowledge of God, and also the inevitability of life. I'm sorry my text was so small compared to the size of the screen. It's always hard to estimate. But I have two questions. What questions about meaning and purpose does this make you ask? And how do you make sense of science? So I'm interested to hear about those. I think we've got some time now for questions and things. What do you think? Does my story work? Or are some... Or if there are bits of the science you didn't understand, don't be shy. Probably, if I explained it badly, probably nobody else understands it either. So.
And Tina's asked if I'll chair questions. So, questions, comments, clarifications? Anyone going to be bold enough? So, one at the back to start, yes.
As a non-scientist, can I ask a really idiotic question?
It won't be idiotic.
You said that there are hundreds of possible universes that actually all of creation has chosen to use just So, where are the others?
Some of them are, actually there are thousands that could potentially exist that would be sort of chemically possible. Some of them are hanging around on meteorites. Some of them are made by proteins to do other stuff. It's just the 20 that are involved in building proteins. So the other ones are all got roles in the rest of creation. But it's just those 20 that have been particularly used by living creatures to build the proteins. Jump in, Andrew, anytime.
Well, one of them is the one that you use to make the urea that's in your urine, getting rid of your waste nitrogen. That's an amino acid, but it's never found in proteins.
Can you just define amino acids?
Amino acids is, well, what she was talking about, the building blocks.
Yeah, but what, chemically, what makes amino acids?
What makes them? Do people really want to know?
Well,
it's a carbon chain with a carboxylate group and an amino group on the other end and a few things stuck on
What's really clever about it is it's like a chain that you would use for a necklace, right? But as Andrew was saying, one is C, carbon joined to oxygen, and then another option, and then hydrogen, that's COOH. And then the other one's nitrogen, hydrogen, hydrogen. And they're both joined to carbon, but they're actually joined to the same carbon. So in fact...
Yeah, it's easier if you think of a magnet with minus and plus, and you have another magnet, plus and minus, and
they all join together.
What's really clever, it's basically a bracelet with pendants hanging off it. So each amino acid takes the same amount of space on the link, because it's just one link wide. But all the dangly stuff coming off it, which is the different parts of amino acids, different sorts of amino acids. So anything can be amino acid, but it's just whether the dependent's any use to make a cell up.
I like your bracelet.
One over there. Yeah. Yeah, the back. Sorry, I can't see you there. For you. Yeah.
You talked about the inevitability of the 20 amino acids, but it's a long way from 20 amino acids to the enormously complex chains that you have in the
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I mean, is that inevitable?
Well, it's happened. And the, I mean, there are clues to the origin of life, or certainly the amino acids arriving on meteorites is a clue. And I wouldn't, there are various theories about how it may have happened. Was there, is the ice ball Earth theory, where these being formed in an, on an icy planet where molecules could be quite stable, were they being formed on clays, almost like a computer chip being laid down? Or were they, we asked Stephen what we thought came first, the DNA, the message, or the protein. And he thinks probably it was the message part and the protein, and DNA came along later. Because the, you don't want to know details. It's kind of exciting.
What about the RNA world? Because, I mean, this is the problem. Yeah, we really don't know. I mean, it's a big mystery. We know it's happened, and we can see the progression through the molecules. But the mechanism is still... There's another whole theory called the RNA world that says RNA...
That's the message.
Yeah, the RNA is the message, but it itself acted as the catalyst. I mean, it's...
It can act like a protein. The message can curl up on itself and start doing clever things. It's really cool.
Gordon, go on.
Yes, to switch, but I met Gordon Stewart. I was an obstetrician, and my research was on the fetal maternal development.
Ah, okay.
I can tell you some wonderful stories about that, which don't involve worms at all, but fearfully and wonderfully means most certainly. David Attenborough says, you're talking about purposeful, loving and purposeful God. David Attenborough says, how can I believe in a God that in fact allows a worm to grow inside a child and then come up and pop out through the child's eye, as it does in Africa? And so there are these questions about, that's not quite so loving. So you then have got to practice, that's all to do with the fall. And of course, that's just a theological smokescreen as well. You've got to be very, very, very careful about it. So, all loving, all purpose. How do you, does David Attenborough's view of that one particular issue fit in with your thoughts?
Yeah, and I was careful when I showed you that picture of that beautiful river with reflection and said that the beauty of creation reflects something of the beauty of God. I did say, you know, if I showed you something I made, you might get a wrong message about what I was like if you tried to overanalyze it. You might think I really enjoyed tinkering with computers, I don't know. So I think we can't find out the whole story about God by looking at his creation. I think we need the message in the Bible, we need to know the person of Jesus, we need to experience what we can in his church. Because you're right, there's suffering in the world. I chose to ignore it in this talk because I think this message is so often not heard. We so often do listen to David Attenborough, and these guys don't get hurt. We have to make our own films, because more often than not, the BBC won't film them, because they're not interested in what they have to say. So that's why I do this. But obviously, your question is incredibly important, and certainly for a medical professional, you're dealing with sick people all the time. That question is on your mind every single day. And it's not a trivial question. And I think my response always, first of all, is... I mean, the logic and the reasoning and the pastoral have to go hand in hand because we're whole people. But certainly I'm much more happy. I have to have the logic there, but I'm my own reason why I'm still a Christian is that I've experienced enough of the goodness of God to trust that there's a bigger story there that I don't understand. In a similar way to the way a child knows their parent loves them, even though their life is ruined every day when they have to go to bed or get up or whatever. I don't think there's going to be a reason for every instance of suffering. I don't mean that. I just mean that we may realise that there's a bigger picture in the end. I mean, of course, some of the sort of logical, rational response is along the lines of, well, what kind of world did God create? And certainly some of our struggles, I think, come from a wrong understanding of the biblical story, which is that God created a paradise for us to live in. That was wonderful, and it was warm, and the sea was warm, and the fruit dropped off the trees, and nobody ever got sick. And people would say, oh, it's like a wonderful tropical island. Now, you and I know tropical islands are full of stuff that's going to kill you. Did God create, a place that was convenient and comfortable for us where we weren't going to suffer? Or did he create somewhere that was more like a boot camp? That's one response. I haven't really picked one. There are about half a dozen ways of responding to this question. I'm sure others could throw in other ways of responding to it. One is that God has to give freedom to creation to do its thing. That was the way he could love creation. And some of that evil comes out of that, or things that we would call evil, natural evil, because it hurts us. Another one, as you mentioned, was the idea of the cosmic fall, the idea that when people started to do wrong, there was a fracture in the natural world and things started to bite, in a sense. Some people think those things that bit were always there. There are all these different ways of responding to it. But for me, as I said earlier with the why I'm a Christian, it's because of experiencing the person of Jesus and seeing what happened to his followers and his followers in the church today in a similar way. I've experienced the goodness of God, even though I have experienced personally some of that suffering that you deal with in hospital every day. That's why I'm still a Christian. That's quite a long answer, but it's quite a difficult question. Yeah. So,
you'd have several talks on that question. Yeah. There was another question here somewhere, I think. Was there? Did I see one? No? Any more?
In that moment, I was backing off from my question because I realised it was rather ridiculous. I'm a simple engineer. Why can't we put this stuff, or why haven't we been able to put this stuff into a bottle and warm it up and make life? I don't understand.
Yeah, well, you need 500 million years for a start. And a million is a long time. I heard of a child who probably ended up at some prestigious university who wanted to know what a million felt like. And he tallied it on his wall every night. I don't know how long it took him.
We've got the stuff.
Yeah.
Why can't we? So we haven't got away for millions of years for that. We have the stuff. Can't we create?
No, that was from chemicals to life.
Oh.
Yeah. So it took that long. And also, you couldn't put it in a bottle. You'd have to leave it on a rocky planet with solar rays interacting with it, with the planet getting maybe different distance from the sun. It's a little bit like I feel the joke when the scientist goes to God and says, I can make life now. And God says, holy cow. The scientist says, let's have a competition. God says, all right, okay, let's have a competition. You make life, I'll make life, let's see who wins. And the scientist says, oh, okay, right, get some dirt. And God is like, hey, that's not fair, get your own dirt. So he's made this universe with the physical constants of all this stuff, so this information is hugely information-rich environment, that life emerges within.
There's a big headline not so long ago with man creates first new life form, and they created a bacteria. But what they've done is taken a selected number of genes from another bacteria and stitched them all together. And they synthesized it in the lab, but that's not really creating life. There is a huge mystery, isn't there? But that's the exciting thing, I think, part of the beauty and wonder of science, is that we do begin to unravel it because we are understanding how God worked. But there's an openness there. We never understand everything.
I'd love to be able to show you a little video that explained exactly how life arrived. Maybe in 100 years we'll have it. It would be great.
Yeah, but it's Pandora's box. You'll answer one question and then you open the box and there's another question.
The fun part. And I love trying to get across that idea that, as a scientist, your job is that you do your work, you publish your paper, you throw it over your shoulder and run at the next question. You're not trying to, have all the answers. You're trying to find out where the areas of ignorance are and run blindly into it, or maybe not blindly.
But the lovely quote, science is not about finding the answers, it's asking the right questions.
Yes.
And that's half the, if you ask the right question, that's the key.
If you can't ask questions, you might as well go home. Yeah. So, yeah.
So,
Yes, yes.
I was just going to make a comment, actually, because if you look, there's physics, chemistry, and biology. And I think I'm a mineral physicist, so I did my PhD on rock minerals, and particularly clays that Ruth actually mentioned as well. And I think maybe what engineers, what's a partial answer to your question, really, is that you've got protons, neutrons, and electrons as the building blocks, but the way that, because they're waves and particles, so that quantum physics bit, makes them build atoms that when they have the electrons on the atoms, which are, this is charge, isn't it? Positive, negative charge. Because they've got to be waves at the same time, there's only a certain number of configurations of electrons, which then has this sort of electron shell thing. So the periodic table is really just quantum mechanics, really, of electrons being waves. That means that atoms are a certain shape and they can build together very much how magnets will just line up with each other. So you can have lots of magnetic filings that make lovely patterns because of north and south. So there's an inbuilt order right from the bottom because of quantum mechanics, actually, and waves being particles. So it's incredibly beautiful right from the word go, and it has a self-assembly to it. So if you shook lots of magnets together, if you go to at Bristol, mm-hmm. they have this lovely, you know, magnet finds with a really strong magnet.
No, they've got really bits, sadly.
Oh, no!
It's gone.
Oh, but there you go. So it's right from the bottom. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like Lego with shapes such that they will fit together, and you can shape them up, and they will form some kind of order. Not Lego world, but mm-hmm. God's Lego world.
Yeah, and one of the chapters in the book I've been writing on is on this statistical mechanics. Oh dear, it nearly broke me trying to write it. But there's the idea that you have this irregular movement, almost like if you had a tray of blocks or something, and you have the irregular movement, but eventually a pattern emerges from on a larger scale from these little tiny movements. And I love that you use the word beautiful for something that sounded really obscure that I didn't really, well, I kind of understood, but not really. And this is the kind of beauty that scientists enjoy, the order and the things that make sense. It's
quite fun. Any other questions or comments? Or? One there?
Yeah, I want to come back to this about the universe being very beautiful and constructed and so on, which I totally agree with in my book, and so on. I must admit, I came back to the previous question. Mm-hmm. I don't know, there seems to be a lack of clarity to me from a Christian perspective about what to do about David asking this question. Mm. It's a very, very good question. Mm. And I think, to me, I think these kind of people, I think the church is starting to feel that it's supposed to be more fancy. Mm. It's supposed to be this, and maybe it's supposed to be like a boot camp. You know? But other people might think, oh, it's fallen, but I can't see how this form works. Where does this form go? Mm. 1,000 years ago, a million years ago, 2 billion years ago, was it coming? You know, so how does this form of Bible fit in what we know about science now?
Yeah.
And to me, these are very big questions. And often, are they really being addressed? Is anybody really thinking about this in depth?
They are beginning to, because we've really only been confronted with evidence for the common origin of everything just in the last few decades, really. So, I mean, in almost incontrovertible evidence. So it's really, by a theologian's timescale, it's a blink of an eye. So people are working on it. I mean, certainly some things, yes, we're confronting the fact that perhaps this, I believe, figurative account of Adam and Eve sinning, turning against God, and it, you know, there's this curse, if you like, the world is going to turn against you. It's going to be difficult for you to farm your land, all this kind of thing. People have taken that as a sign that from that first wrongdoing, the whole world fell apart, and we got wasps that sting and worms that crawl into infants' eyes. But we know that dinosaurs had arthritis before that. So we're being confronted with that evidence that there was what we would call suffering before then. Now, certainly the child's eye disease may well be caused by human evil. If the child is not well cared for, if they don't have good nutrition, why is the worm attacking them? Are they in dirty water? I mean, a lot of human disease and sickness you can trace back to human selfishness. And certainly the more we understand about the world, the more we will find that out. You know, the earthquake happens and then the disaster happens as the badly built buildings fall down on top of people. So I think we have a lot to answer for there. So before we point the finger at God, I think we have to point the finger at ourselves and say, help us God, to behave rightly in this world. And certainly you only have to work in palliative care to see what, in a sense, the way dying should be like. You know, that I would much rather, you know, than being by myself under a tree, I'd much rather be in a Marie Curie hospital, thank you very much. And that was incredible. That's incredible to see how, with our God-given gifts and our vocation to look after each other, we can alleviate suffering and look after people. So I think that's one layer of the conversation that can happen. I mean, I think there are so many different layers.
There is
twitching at me and looking at their watches.
But there is a very interesting thing. I went to a lecture recently at Trinity College. I found very helpful because the word in creation that we translate, it was good. The word means fit for purpose, but more than that, it means a continuing process. And one of the aspects that came out was that we, when we're given in Genesis 2, the command to be good stewards, we are actually continuing God's creative process. In a sense, almost making more perfect, putting right. And sin then gets in the way because we don't do what God has given us the duty to do.
Because there was something to tame there. It said, yeah. Go and... I've forgotten the word. There was something to put order in. Yeah. People were to go out and put order into the world.
Subdue.
That's the one. Yeah. And I've just forgotten the other thought. If it was important, it'll come back to me.
Yeah. Quickly, and then we must be able to raise that.
Sorry, just my take on it, really, is if you understand a bit of biology, the point is that when your body cells are doing what they do, they don't kind of know where they are in the body. They're just giving chemical signals, which will then tell them what to do. So much of what our body does, or the environment embryo does, is actually chemical. So it's not a sort of, the worm isn't wanting to go and find these eyes and come out of them. The worm, just like our white blood cells and red blood cells, they just do what they do because of the chemistry. Well, this worm finds itself inside a child's body and just, you know, goes where it goes. I think you could put a lot of things inside a child's body and it would do very strange things. So I think you can't blame the worm. I mean, the worm's not kind of saying, oh, goody, let's do this. So, you know, I think we're
I don't think anyone's trying to blame the worm.
But they're blaming God.
The
point is, this is a world where we're creatures. We are all creatures. And this is a world which is interactive. And we can do good, we can do evil, we have freedom to affect each other. But this is a flip side, that we can be affected by things around us. And cancer, you know, we need mutations to make life evolve. Well, the flip side, you get cancer going wrong, you know, so it's called The Only Way. That's Dennis Alexander.
That's another, yeah.
And also Rhoda Hawkins, because she talks a lot about restrictive mentors.
I was going to say, and the Bible is clear that creation is groaning, and this world is not it, and it is full of suffering, and Christians are promised problems. You know, it's not promised to have a perfect life. So I mean, that I can hold on to that hope, you know, when I have lost a relative to something horrific, you know, that I will see them again, or that this life isn't it, and I'm, you know, that we are promised something better and an end to it. So there is that's an inkling of the grand picture that we can't see, I think, that I will eventually understand why these things had to happen.
Well, I think if we could solve the problem we've been talking about, you'd get a Nobel Prize or something.
Oh, yeah.
Difficult. So thank you very much, Ruth. And just that sense of awe and wonder and inspiration is very infectious. So thank you indeed very much. Yeah, let's give Ruth a round of applause again. A couple of quick things. Do please make a donation so that we can... come across tonight, the bowl is there, so before you go out, that'd be great. There is a list here. If you haven't signed up to be on our email list, so you get reminders of what's going on, do sign up on this. We'll leave it here, over there. Yeah. And there's plenty of stuff here for you to look at, from Christians in Silence and all the stuff that Ruth has bought. So do look at that and mingle for a few minutes. That'd be great. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.